You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Let me just offer a very brief welcome. My name is Kasia Malinowska. I direct the drug policy program here at OSF. And I wanted to mostly thank our panelists for, first of all, great work on the report, for the presentations that and comments that they are about to offer, and to say that I had an opportunity to travel to the region that we will be hearing about. I think it was 3 years ago, Diego. 3 years ago, and really fell in love with it. And so it feels really great to be here now that the report is available to us all. Diego, who will take over from me, has done a great job sort of moving the project along. So just thank you all for to all the people that contributed, that will contribute to making sure that COCA is discussed in a context of peace in Colombia. And Diego, over to you. Thanks.
Thank you, Kasia. Welcome, everyone. My name is Diego Garcia. I'm with the Global Drug Policy Program here at Open Society Foundations. As Kasia said, I'm in charge of our program in Latin America. And we decided a few years ago to gravitate around the farmers and the coca growers' rights. That meant to us a great challenge, identifying partners in the region that were able to promote and protect rights of people that have been deprived of their right to livelihoods, their right to cultivate an Asian plant like coca. As you know, coca has been grown in the Andean region for different purposes for centuries now. And the Single Convention, the United Nations Single Convention on Drugs, basically changed the meaning of that plant around the world. And now what we see is the governments and states interpreting that convention and pressuring those communities to eradicate coca. That obviously has limited the capacity that governments and communities have had to research and understand what benefits the plant can bring. For the very first time, we found researchers in the region that were able to demonstrate that the plant has different uses and has licit uses. And I'm very happy to say that after a few years of work with Dora Troyano and later with David Restrepo, we are able to present the very first positive approach to coca in the region. That means that Colombia has moved from only criminalizing coca plantations in Colombia to look at the plant differently. That means finding ways on how to make a living for those communities from a licit perspective on the uses of coca. So Dora has been working with those communities. We're gonna see a short video portraying and showing the communities themselves, so you have an image of what Dora has been promoting for almost 20 years now in the region. I'm happy to say that she is the first one in Colombia that has received a permit to buy, transport, stock, and research about coca uses. So that's the major gain that we want to show you today. Please feel free to take copies when you leave and come and talk to the panelists later. So without any further ado, please, we're going to watch the short film, and later we're going to hear from our authors and panelists. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Lucy Sheriff, and I'm a British journalist based in Colombia. I report primarily on social and economic issues for a variety of media outlets, including Public Radio International, Al Jazeera, the BBC, and The Atlantic. The piece still has finally provided space for Colombia to address some of the pressing issues that have been neglected because of the 50-year conflict. These include development in rural and isolated areas, such as those highlighted in the report. Labour Minister Rafael Pardo, who I interviewed late last year, acknowledged that establishing a stable economy in remote regions is a key factor in ensuring peace as a lasting entity. In my reporting from Colombia, I've witnessed there is a dire need for economic infrastructure, especially in rural areas. Up till now, unfortunately, this has not been a priority for the government. And so it seems creating innovation and industrialization from the bottom up is key. There is a huge opportunity for coca, which is already an established part of Colombian culture, to play an integral role in bringing income and prosperity to these areas. Not only does coca have its roots in ancient traditions, but thanks to its nutritional qualities, it could have a prospective market on the international stage. If coca can just manage to shake its bad PR image, there seems to be no reason why it cannot become the next pitaya, quinoa, or matcha, and be the next big superfood. So, without further ado, I'd like to hand over to Paul Gutenberg. He's a SUNY Distinguished Professor of History and Sociology and Chair of the History Department at Stony Brook University. He is also the author of a number of books, including Andy and Cocaine, The Making of a Global Drug, and he'll be exploring the changing possibilities of coca.
Thank you, Lucy. Thank you to the OSF for this opportunity. I have to say, it's not every day that an academic historian like myself opens up a kind of a policy event like this on the industrialization of coca, and I hope that a little bit of history is going to help illuminate things for you. Okay, so my introduction today, I'm going to lay out a few of the bigger contexts for the urgency of this remarkable project on coca industrialization in Colombia, especially coca's ever-changing roles and possibilities in the Andes. Two brief topics, I hope. Historically, coca leaf's dramatic shifts in status over the last century or so, opening up a new space for coca innovation. And second, geographically and politically, over, say, the last decade, the dramatic divergence of coca possibilities in the three Andean nations and Colombia's unique opportunity here. Of course, the historian in me, what I'd really like to get into today, and I'm sure there's not going to be time for it, would be to go back to the 19th century when there actually was a period of a global market in coca health products, and it was very promising before it got cut off by drug prohibition. But I think we'll have to leave that kind of excursion to the Q&A. Okay, so why don't we start by talking a little bit about coca's changing historical status and spaces. Coca leaf, as opposed to its most famous alkaloid, cocaine, is derived from the shrub erythroxylon coca and is one of the oldest cultivars in the Andean region, about 5,000 to 8,000 years old. And as most of you probably know here, the use of coca as a ritual or as a community good, a medicine, a labor enhancer, so on, the uses are innumerable, is deeply ingrained in indigenous lifeways, especially in the southern Andes. Yet, it's vital to grasp that coca is not some kind of timeless, eternal tradition, but has dramatically shifted its status and uses over time. Let me just give you a kind of timeline of these kind of historic ups and downs of the leaf, which have been sometimes very, very dramatic and are still going on. Okay, so it's true that coca dates to some of the earliest Andean peoples, but only by the time of the Incas, that is the 13th and 14th century, did the leaf become elevated and regulated as a kind of sacred substance. After 1532, with the Spanish conquest, the opposite occurs. Coca status falls dramatically. The church branded it kind of a paganistic ritual, and there was a brief attempt to ban the leaf. In the 1530s, 1550s, okay. But coca's use actually expanded throughout the Andes over the next three centuries under colonialism. That's because it became used as a labor stimulant. You've probably all heard of the mines of Potosí And it also began to infiltrate wider into communities. It became a marker, as our anthropologists would call it, became a marker of Indian or indigenous status in the colonial period. Now, in the 19th century, coca saw a new and basically unknown rise in its possibilities and its status as new Andean nations were formed. And when the Germans discovered in 1860 this powerful alkaloid, cocaine, that's within the coca leaf. So now coca was changing because it was linked to a modern miracle drug and a valuable medical commodity. So both national elites in these countries, as well as Americans and Europeans, became fascinated, especially medical men, with this leaf and its miraculous properties. And this led to that brief period, 3 or 4 decades, when there actually was an active international market in coca products, basically health goods. The most famous of these was Vin Mariani in Europe, one of the more pioneering commodities of the late 19th century, and its copycat here in the United States, which was mixed more with sugar than with alcohol, Coca-Cola, which has its roots in this broad period of fascination with coca as a medicinal, coca as a health product. By the way, I do want to mention something that only a few historians would know. The term industrialization of coca is actually very, very old. And it goes back to this period of the late 19th century. But in the late 19th century, it meant only one thing. It meant the production of medicinal cocaine, and chiefly in Peru, where most of the cocaine was being made at that time. Okay, so this was not only prelude to another set of changes. In the early 20th century, coca's fortunes radically changed again. Its status was fell dramatically with the rise of global drug prohibitions and related racial addiction pseudosciences. It's a long and complex story, but by the 1920s, Criollo elites in Peru, Bolivia, and even Colombia medicalized coca. They embraced this new kind of addiction idea and began to brand coca as a kind of mass degenerating social disease of the indigenous masses. That is, coca became equated with cocaine for the first time. Coca also lost its honorable place as a modern export abroad as the US and other places paradoxically banned import of this completely harmless leaf because of their dread of the drug cocaine. By the 1940s, restrictions on coca began to be in the air, a move epitomized in the Andes by the famous 1949-1950 UN mission of inquiry on the coca leaf to the Andes. All of this turn against coca culminates in the 1961 UN Single Convention Treaty, still, as most of you know, the kind of bedrock treaty of global drug control, drug prohibition, which not only for the first time listed coca itself as a drug, but launched the concept of actually eliminating the plant and indigenous habit, of course, in a kind of a quarter century span. That would have been 1986 or so. Okay, yet the worst was to come after that, and that is coca criminalization. In the 1970s and 1980s, the birth of modern circuits of criminal and illicit cocaine, a long-term result, I would argue, of the prohibition system itself, led to coca's most beleaguered stage ever, paradoxically at a time when its cultivation spread or reached unprecedented proportions across the eastern Andes. Cocaine booms in Bolivia, Peru, and finally Colombia, and spiraling violence and corruption around this lucrative drug led to US-inspired campaigns to actually eradicate the leaf, as it was called during that time, at its source. These were erratically carried out, more so in one place than others. But what this was not only a criminalization of cocaine, but this was also, importantly, a criminalization of people. The tens of thousands of new cocalero growers in hotspots like the Chapare, Huallaga, and Putumayo. And of course, among other paradoxes, this post-1980s global drug war targeting coca wasted billions and intensified bloodshed in coca regions, but ultimately did almost nothing to stem the plantings ballooning all across the eastern Andes. But that's not even the end of the story there, because there's been a recent turn in the history of coca that is really the prelude to what we're looking at here today. And that is, starting in the 1970s, making coca's story even more sinuous and complex, the opposite counter move takes off, and that is the so-called revindication of coca. And it's very little studied how this actually occurred. An intriguing coalition of new indigenista movements, global anthropologists, and drug specialists, in a backlash to the repression and violence in the Andean drug war, re-embraced herbal coca leaf. Coca's status quickly rose, this time as a noble, healthy, and essential element of beleaguered Andean cultures, and basically as the opposite of the savage capitalist drug cocaine. And this is a view that's particularly pronounced, as probably most of you know, in Bolivia, where it's become really an integral part of what is nationalism in the country today. So in sum, after about year 2000, it's safe to say that coca's separate, kind of safe, and symbolic space has been largely restored. The plant, that is, the leaf, that is. I would not say the same for the tens of thousands of cocoleros who are still being persecuted under outdated drug laws. So let me just sum this up. Do I have more time, or is it a few minutes? Okay. I hope the main takeaway that you get from this is that you can see now that coca leaf, rather than having kind of one static role or meaning, has significantly shifted over time, most of the time over the last century, closely linked in a dialectic with the drug cocaine. But for a variety of reasons today, coca has unprecedented dynamic possibilities, including a return to coca industrialization and medical usage that briefly flourished a century before drug prohibitions took hold. So I guess I'll stop there and let the show go on.
Thank you, Paul. I also now have the honor of introducing the report's two authors, Dora Troiano Sanchez and David Restrepo, as well as Maria Clara Torres, an internationally published researcher in coca. Dora is an instructor and researcher with the National Training Service, SENA, in Colombia, and has worked for nearly 20 years with coca farmers, researching and promoting the coca leaf as an agricultural product that can contribute to the economic development of coca-growing communities. David works on drug reform policy and product innovation in Colombia and Peru, with a focus on the coca leaf. Maria is a PhD candidate in the history department at Stony Brook University. Her research focuses on coca in Colombia from the early 1950s to the 2000s. So now they're all gonna take to the stage and we can have more of a discussion about the report.
Thank you, Lucy. Can you see if this works? Great. Yeah, so I think I'd like to recapitulate some of the points that you've seen in the movie and some of the points Paul has raised, because they really form the story of this report. I think what we need to say, you know, to begin this story is that in Colombia, the attitude towards coca growers has been basically to try to eradicate and substitute their crops. Unlike Peru and Bolivia, we have not really entertained an alternative from a state perspective that has never really featured in the discourse. And the motivation for this, of course, the main story that we hear is that we needed to get coca, to get rid of cocaine at source, you know, to stop the cartels the guerrillas and the paramilitaries. But the other thing that has always been going on with COCA in Colombia is an older motivation. And it is this derision towards COCA and its association with indigenous cultures, in which COCA is a very prominent part. So the goal in that move was to suppress anything that linked us to our indigenous ancestors. We are a very mixed race culture, a culture that is a product of many peoples coming together and mixing, and the indigenous element of it is very prominent. So as we were looking at drafting this report, we have scanned the drug policy scholarship, and anybody who has looked at the evidence dispassionately has found that this punitive approach towards COCA just doesn't seem to work. It strengthened the guerrillas and the paramilitaries by alienating the rural communities where COCA was grown, and really tearing them apart and pushing them into the hands of those very armed groups and cartels that the policy was trying to weaken. And it is really only until 2016, with the peace agreement between the government and FARC, that Colombia has been starting to think differently about the COCA issue. It is the first time that we have started talking about consensus-based strategies for development and drug control, and imagine that communities could maybe decide the future of their lives and their properties themselves. So what we do with the COCA industrialization report is to maybe take another step forward, and is one where we try to acknowledge the right of COCA farmers, be they indigenous or otherwise. The community that you saw, Lerma, is a multi-ethnic community. People there will not associate themselves as indigenous, but as mixed race. So the right of these coca farmers to grow coca, if they choose to, for the variety of beneficial and, I would even say, irreplaceable uses that coca offers. So in the report, we cover this long history that coca has in Colombia. We scan the laws that have tried to suppress coca for a long time, and then begin to look at the cultural and economic value that the plant offers both to indigenous and to multi-ethnic communities. So we start by presenting the nutritional uses that the plant offers, reporting on a recent study of the nutritional content that coca has. We similarly look at that contentious legal history of the plant and identify the small gray area that currently allows indigenous communities to grow coca and sell coca-based products, but that prevents the plant from really accessing the potential it has within a formal commercial setup. So right now, coca retains a very restrictive terrain, one that really prevents it from reaching its potential in nutrition, medicine, and agriculture. Under different circumstances, as Paul briefly mentioned, Colombia, like Peru and Bolivia today, would see coca as a source of pride and maybe even of opportunity. At elevation, coca helps with altitude sickness. Coca is a superfood. It has almost as much protein as beans and lentils. It's a remarkable source of calcium, phosphorus, and iron. As an input in fertilizers, coca not only provides a low-cost source of nitrogen, but also appears to repel insects. So it helps reduce the need for pesticides. As a stimulant, there is no evidence that it causes harm or addiction. It's a steady, constant source of energy that also helps people feel calmer and more focused while suppressing the appetite. So while you're chewing coca, you may not need to snack. It is providing nutrition to you, and it is also making you feel like you're satiated. So if we could overcome the stigma that the plant has and the fear that has prevented us researching all the valuable uses of coca, We would find that this plant could suddenly be a source of social good and wealth rather than a fuel for war. This wouldn't solve all of our problems, either in development or in drugs, but it would certainly make a valuable contribution. The final component of the report looks at the horizons of the coca leaf. Where should we go next? And to do this, we look at the experience of Sena and the town of Lerma, which you saw earlier, in the state of Cauca, which remains the third largest producer of coca in Colombia. And Dora will cover this with a lot more richness than I can with her two-decade experience working in the area. But I think what is really beautiful about Lerma is how Lerma has reclaimed its identity by accepting coca as a part of who they are and as a part of the connection that we have to our ancestors and to the land. And it's through that process that the conditions have been set for experiencing or exploring the valuable uses of coca. And I think that experience is also a very valuable template for policymakers and for reformers. What it does is it tells us that where we need to start is understanding what communities need, conducting research, experimentation, and innovation based on those community needs that we have identified, and reforming policies with considering how, through those technological innovations, we can address the needs that the community has identified for itself. Through that process, I think Dora and Sena obtained the first permit in Colombia's history for conducting research with coca. And I think they're helping to set the research foundation that will help us demonstrate how important coca leaf is in our society and potentially put punitive drug policy behind for good. So I'll now switch over to Dora, who has led these efforts for decades, and working with communities has been showing us that a different path is possible.
Buenas tardes para todos.
To everyone.
Muchas gracias. Buenas tardes, hija. Ella es la más pendiente. Fue la que llegó primero al salón. Le ganó a todos.
She came first. She was the most interested person here. She made sure she was here on time. Very much on time.
Primero que todo, gracias por darse la oportunidad de tomar un tiempito para escucharnos. Muchas gracias por sacar tiempo de sus agendas para acompañarnos en este proceso tan largo y por fin tener este hijito. Es el primer hijito que tenemos David y yo, pero es como es un hijo con muchos papás, porque está Casia, está Diego, está toda la gente de la Open, están todos mis compañeros del SENA, con quienes hubiera sido, o sea, sin ellos hubiera sido imposible hacer este trabajo.
First of all, thank you for taking the time to come here and for taking the time to, in your agendas, making the space to come listen about this topic. This would be our first baby, and a baby with many fathers. I would say we can count among them Diego, and I am missing probably a couple of people.
Diego, Casia, and todos los de la OPE.
People from OPE that have contributed to this.
Y mis compañeros del SENA.
And my colleagues from SENA too. I want to thank you then for this first baby that I have in my hands this time.
Cuando empezamos a escribir este reporte, cuando se dio la oportunidad de empezar a escribir este reporte, siempre pensé que iba a ser un trabajo muy fácil, pero con el tiempo me di cuenta que se complicaba porque la coca no es unidireccional. La coca, así como su distribución en todos los Andes, tiene que ver con múltiples estados de gobiernos, estados, estados de ánimo, gente, y la coca tiene una identidad según la persona que la interpreta.
This work, in the beginning, I thought it was going to be a simple one, but as I got into it, it became complicated as I enter in, I continue doing it. Because coca is not a unidirectional entity or product, it's really taken and it really spreads out or takes many different facets depending on the cultural, the government approach, the mood, many other factors that really change what coca means for different regions in the Andes.
Para tener un contexto muy general, la coca es una planta que pertenece a la familia botánica de las erictrosiláceas, que solo tiene tres géneros botánicos, uno de los cuales es el que tiene alcaloide de cocaína.
To just talk about the leaf, belongs to the family of electrosilices or electrosilaceas. One of them has, there are three in total, and one of them has this in its content, this alcaloid.
Cocaína, no, which, el único que tiene.
Cocaína. Which would be what we know as cocaine.
Y se distribuye en Colombia, Bolivia, Perú y Ecuador.
It's distributed in Bolivia, Peru and Ecuador.
Es una zona restringida, o sea, no se puede dar plantaciones grandes en otros lugares del mundo.
It's a restricted or limited area by policy. They cannot be larger. In any other part of the world, it's allowed to have those large amounts of plantation or cultivation or growth of the leaf.
Como lo decía el profesor Gutenberg hace un momento, esta planta ha acompañado a las comunidades andinas durante los últimos siglos, pero solamente durante el último siglo, después de la prohibición, se convirtió en un problema para las comunidades propias de la región andina.
As Professor Gutenberg has expressed, this plant has been accompanying or being part of the life of indigenous the Andean community, and up until the last half of the century that after prohibition, that this plant has been affected by this program or this pressure on it and on the communities that grow it.
Y es un problema más agudo en Colombia porque cuando se firmó la Convención de Estupefacientes, nuestros hermanos peruanos y bolivianos se sustrajeron de firmar la Convención en su totalidad, respetando la presencia de sus comunidades indígenas en los territorios.
And after the drug convention, when that was established or presented to the countries, Bolivia, Peru, and Colombia, Bolivia and Peru opted out of certain guidelines or opted out of it completely on its totality because of the effect that was going to for respect to their indigenous communities.
En cambio, Colombia no se sustrajo, entonces la prohibición cubrió a todo el país, a todo el territorio, desconociendo los usos ancestrales de la hoja que habían sido tradicionales en los territorios, tanto indígenas como mestizos tradicionales.
So Colombia did not take a step away or resign or didn't submit to submit it actually to this convention, and by doing that they ignored and didn't take into consideration the tradition of the not just indigenous but mestizo communities that cultivated or grew it.
Actualmente tenemos más de 130,000 familias asociadas al cultivo de hoja de coca con un mercado absolutamente ilegal, en el mercado ilegal.
At this point we have 130,000 families involved in the commercialization and growth of the coca leaf, and it's all done illegally. They market it, but it's all considered illegal.
Entonces, cuando hablamos de industrialización de la hoja de coca, lo que nosotros proponemos es generar espacios legales que permitan al productor elegir a quién venderle su producto.
So when we talk about the industrialization of the coca leaf, we are talking about creating an environment for the grower and product people who produce it or to market it to find a space to do it and to carry their business or carry their subsistence.
Para personas de los otros países de América Latina puede ser algo obvio, pero en Colombia tenemos muchísimas restricciones legales. Entonces, cuando empezamos a hacer este reporte y uno de los objetivos del reporte era generar una ruta legal que nos permitiera hacer este ejercicio.
So for this might sound obvious for other countries, but in Colombia we have many legal restrictions. So the goal of this report is to provide a way or a road, a roadmap for this industrialization and provide change a little bit the game on the question of the coca leaf.
Finalmente, lo que esperamos con este reporte es que las personas tengan la oportunidad de ser valoradas como cultivadores, como agricultores, no solamente como agricultores de coca o cultivadores de coca, sino como cultivadores que aprecian la tierra, su territorio y las posibilidades de vivir de un producto agrícola que puedan comercializar en un ejercicio de libertad.
So the hopes that we have with the people who read this report is to give value to the people who are growing, farmers, the coca farmers, not just because they are growing or marketing the coca leaf, but also because they have a connection to the soil and the environment that surrounds them, and they have respect for their livelihood that surrounds them, for how they make a living.
En un principio pensamos que esta era la respuesta que queríamos, pero cuando tenemos esa respuesta nos salen mil preguntas más.
And in the beginning, we thought we had the answer for the question, but as soon as we answered it, 1,000 other questions emerged, came up.
Y ahí estamos, invitando a la gente a que sumemos para hacer investigación sobre coca, que podamos argumentar avances sobre coca y sobre todo que podamos unir fuerzas para conseguir unas opciones posibles y creativas para un conflicto que nos está costando tantas vidas en Colombia.
So that's where we are right now. We want more to join us in the investigation and discussion about this topic, not just to find viable and also workable ways for the industrialization and to put an end to this terrible conflict, a painful conflict that we've had in Colombia.
Entonces la invitación, como siempre, es a que si en un mercado se encuentran algún producto de hoja de coca distinto a la Coca-Cola, por favor lo consuman, porque cuando lleguen, que son libres también de consumir cocaína si quieren, pero la idea es generar espacios nuevos para los productos alternativos de hoja de coca.
So please, when you see in the market some other products apart or other than Coca-Cola, and also obviously you are free to consume cocaine if you want to, but if you find any other product, please use it, consume it, use it for yourselves. Try to, if you see a product, a coca-based product in the market, use it and incorporate it to your life, if you can.
Thank you very much, Darío. That was incredibly insightful. I'd now like to hand over to María Clara, who is going to be commenting on the report and the current challenges in Colombia.
Good afternoon, everyone. Well, I'm delighted to be here and to talk about coca and the challenges for post-conflict Colombia, precisely exactly 5 days before presidential elections in Colombia, when for the first time a leftist candidate is one of the front runners, which is significant because thousands of leftist people have been killed and assassinated over the past decades just because of the stigma associated with the FARC. So I think that whether or not the leftist candidate is elected, I think that in any case, he will be the chief of the opposition if he's not elected, and the left will have to be taken into account, and that matters because that candidate is a staunch critic of the war on drugs. So I have entitled my presentation, Making Peace with Coca, Challenges for Post-Conflict Colombia. In recent years, calls for rethinking the war on drugs seem to open up new democratizing opportunities for grassroots coca communities. For half a century, the Andean countries have been on the front line of the war on drugs. And now, it seems that even the elites are questioning the effectiveness of the strategy. The region, as one of the journalists said, I open quotation marks, the region seemed tired of paying the price for America's war on its favorite vices. End of quote. So at least in Colombia, it is clear now that neither, for at least part of the elites, or the most progressive elites, that neither military intervention nor alternative development has worked. So that means that neither the carrot nor the stick has actually worked, because a significant amount of cocaine are still coming out of the country. And after billions of dollars and pesos spent under Plan Colombia, coca actually returned to the previously fumigated areas and also spread to new areas. So it seems that, as Colombian journalists rightly stated, that at least part of the elites are understanding what one of the Colombian journalists stated once. He said, "Illicit coca can neither be created nor destroyed, but only displaced." So, in addition to these calls for drug policy reform, there was hope in Colombia that bringing an end to the conflict with the FARC would actually solve Colombia's drug problem. So the government promised land reform and investment in the countryside, in the periphery actually, in exchange for eradication of coca, for coca eradication. And with the peace agreements, the FARC would no longer, that was what part of it was the negotiation about, the FARC would no longer be an obstacle to coca eradication, but they would actually become part of the solution. So the FARC committed to cut off all ties to the drug trade. But from the beginning, I argued that the peace deal with the FARC could not be assessed by the reduction in the number of coca hectares. The disarmament of a guerrilla of more than 10,000 fighters was already an achievement. And in the most optimistic scenario, if actually rural reforms were to be carried out, were to be implemented, they could actually improve the livelihoods of grassroots coca communities and provide relief to them, which is, of course, a desirable outcome. But in any case, the peace agreement with the FARC would not quash the cocaine industry. I argued that while cocaine remains an internationally prescribed substance, the elevated prices driven by this prohibition would compel the production for a criminal black market. So aiming at full legalization of cocaine was clearly not a realistic goal for a peace agreement. But decriminalization of small coca producers seemed reasonable.
I mean, if it was not time for radical change, it was perhaps possible to humanize what they call humanize the war on drugs, and that the Colombian version of this is humanization of the war on drugs. Part of this global movement in Colombia would be expressed by perhaps a possible decriminalization of at least small-scale producers of cocoa. And so the peace agreement did seek a more peaceful approach to coca farming communities. But the peace agreement, the peace deal, actually failed to specify who were considered small-scale producers. So this decision or this definition of who are to be considered small cocaleros, small producers of coca, was left actually to the legislators, to Congress. So, and recently, the Santos administration, the President Santos, drafted a bill seeking a differentiated penal treatment for coca growers. Unfortunately, the bill has been sent to Congress. It has not been voted yet. It has not been debated, but it has to be debated and voted in the coming days. But as of today, the bill seems disappointing. In what sense? In the sense that it is not an indefinite exemption from criminal charges for small coca growers. So the bill has two main components, and I'll explain it very quickly. It seeks to shield from criminal persecution, from criminal prosecution, small farmers with plots no bigger than 1.78 hectares. Just to give you an idea, according to UNODC, the average farm, the average coca farm in Colombia is 1 hectare. So the bill has defined small coca hectares. Those who own plots or who occupy plots no bigger than 1.78 hectares. That's one of the components. The other component, they shield them from criminal prosecution, but that means that they have to sign up for a substitution agreement. They still have to substitute. I mean, they're not prosecuted, but the condition is that they have to eradicate coca. So it's kind of, it's almost like an administrative measure. It's just a measure so that the government can actually implement alternative development projects. And people can benefit from these projects without being prosecuted. You know, because if they are illegal, then the government shouldn't be implementing rural programs, right? They could not benefit from this. So the second component is to release small coca farmers from jail. And that would affect approximately 250 people who are actually incarcerated for owning or for occupying plots of coca. And that is a kind of a reduced amount of people if one considers that almost 400,000 people depend on coca for their survival in Colombia now. So this bill is a temporary provision to allow small coca farmers to benefit from alternative development programs without being prosecuted. It does not legalize indefinitely the production of small amounts of coca. And the bill comes after the Trump administration threatened to decertify Colombia as a cooperative partner in the in drug control efforts. So I think that like the spirit the initial idea that the peace agreement had of seeking a more peaceful approach to coca growers is not clear anymore, at least not by Congress at this moment. I think this is Colombia is, I mean, at a year and a half after the signing of the peace agreement, Colombia hasn't really made much progress in going beyond the prohibitionist paradigm. Colombia has continued to wage the war on drugs while implementing very slowly the rural reform promised in the peace agreement. So they're doing both things. They're trying and they're doing it very slowly to do carry out rural reforms in the periphery, but at the same time, they're waging the war on drugs. They are implementing forced eradication. So and here's what I argue is the prohibitionist approach with its corollary military intervention is a serious obstacle to consolidating peace in Colombia. Counter-narcotics campaigns have continued to spark violence, human rights abuses, and social unrest. So, now, after the peace agreement, it seems that the communities are actually caught in the fight between illegal armed groups for the control of the territories once oversaw by the FARC. And that includes the old ELN guerrilla, new brands of paramilitaries, including and also the Sinaloa cartel, Mexico. So since the signing of the revised peace agreement in November 2016, illegal armed groups have killed hundreds of community leaders for embracing coca substitution programs. And to make matters worse, now the police has access to remote coca growing areas that were once controlled by the FARC. So instead, this new access, now that the police has access to this area, instead of improving the security of people, it is putting them in harm's way. And what do I mean by this? For instance, a few months ago in the municipality of Tumaco, Nariño, the police opened fire on a crowd who had gathered to resist forced eradication. And they killed at least 7 coca farmers. So it seems that now the situation is even worse, that the police can have access to these areas because grassroots communities are now threatened whether they pull out coca or not. They're threatened if they pull out coca by illegal or armed groups, and if they don't, by the police. So Colombia will not achieve, I argue that Colombia will not achieve lasting peace until it actually stops creating seedbeds for drug trafficking gangs. And that means legalizing the production of small amounts of coca. Coca industrialization could potentially become a promising economic tool for post-conflict, as shown in the report by Dora Troyano and David Restrepo. Yet, as Diego Garcia rightly pointed out in the foreword, and I open quotation mark, he says, one cannot be naive and suggest that coke industrialization will fully absorb the illicit market. So I argue that it is necessary to make peace with coca. And that's one of the challenges of of post-conflict Colombia. And that means legalizing the production of limited amounts of coca for the drug market, as controversial as this statement might be. But in Colombia, by contrast to Bolivia, for instance, the vast majority of the leaves are planted to supply the drug market. Only 3% of the population self-identifies as indigenous. And not all of these ethnic groups have actually an ancestral tradition of coca consumption. So the Nazas, for instance, the Nazas of the north of Cauca, which are kind of the emblematic indigenous group with ancestral ties to coca, we have to say that daily consumption of coca, as it still happens in the Yungas in Bolivia, I guess, daily consumption in the north of Cauca by Nazas was extinguished long before the 1980s cocaine boom. It was extinguished before the cocaine boom and mainly due to racism, although the history is more complex. But even the report also, and that's why I like the report, the report also mentions the 1940s public health campaigns held by the hygienists, by the modernist physicians, right, to eradicate coca consumption and to eradicate chicha, for instance. So today, even in Cauca, coca is used even in the north of Cauca on special occasions by religious authorities. That said, there is a movement. There is an emergent movement, as I think, as Professor Paul Gutenberg mentioned, that there is a movement to reaffirm and to reinvent cultural identity, and to reinvent and reaffirm the roots to ancestral coca. But even the NASA produce mostly to supply the drug market. They supply to produce the Sinaloa cartel, right? And they don't not only produce coca, but also produce cannabis, okay? But there is a movement. And with that, I will conclude. And that I will just conclude with this, is that after almost half a century of, people from different backgrounds in Colombia, such as indigenous group, Afro-Colombian and mestizos, have planted coca. And now I think we have to go beyond the dichotomy of if they have an instrumental relationship with the plant, or if they have an ancestral or cultural identity. I think that now in Colombia, after almost half a century, there is a mestizo and colono coca culture in Colombia. And we have to acknowledge that. And that it's different from the cultural ties that they could have in Bolivia, but there is a mestizo and colono coca culture. And that's why I think that one of the challenges for post-conflict Colombia is to make peace with coca now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, everyone, for your comments. I believe we now have some time for questions from the audience. If I could ask you to keep them concise, that would be very helpful, as I'm very conscious we're limited on time. We have a microphone that's going to be passed around. Okay. Would you like to? So the microphone's back there. I don't know if you want to.
So please be also mindful that we're recording the event, and later will be available in the website. So if you don't want to be in the recording, please speak off the microphone.
Okay. I have three brief statements. I have always thought, not always, but for a very long time, that controversial subjects like this should not be promulgated without the other side offering the opposite view. I'm thinking I have two granddaughters in junior high school, and if they thought that cocoa was all right, they might be offered it and they might try it. And I do have an experience to tell everybody here, and maybe you'll understand then. I have the fast thing. Yes, after I'm going to ask you to tell me what's wrong with what I'm saying, because I really would like to know. I have a girlfriend who has a grandson who had three car accidents under the influence of marijuana and threatened his mother that if she didn't buy him another car, he was going to tell the police that she had alcohol parties in her house. It did something to his brain. I want to know how you debate what I just said.
So what exactly is the question in relation to the report?
The question is, should you be allowed to promulgate this? And how do you protect our young children? How do you make them think otherwise, that it's not all right? Because we have children whose minds are not developed yet. How do you prevent all that?
Okay, so perhaps a good question to answer would be, how do you ensure the public knows the difference between coca, the nutritional value of coca, and cocaine? Because obviously coca has a very bad PR image because it is, you know, used to make cocaine. So how do you try and differentiate that? Is it a PR campaign that needs to run? Is it sort of from the bottom up? Education needs to happen.
La respuesta puede ser un poco cliché diciendo que estamos hablando del consumo de la hoja en su integridad. El tema nuestro no es la cocaína. La cocaína, el consumo, el tráfico y los negocios alrededor de ella forman parte de otros especialistas. Nosotros estamos hablando de la posibilidad de hablar de la hoja entera, la hoja en forma natural, transformada en harinas y a partir de ella sacar, obviamente es una hoja que contiene cocaína, pero en una mínima cantidad, y la propuesta es trabajar a partir de la integralidad de la hoja. El tema de cocaína, consumo, los consumos problemáticos, corresponden a otras personas que tienen más información que nosotros al respecto, por lo menos que yo.
My answer might sound cliche, but we are focused on.
Thank you. We're focused. We are the purpose of our study is to find an integral use for the coca leaf. The topic of the consumption, traffic, and other things that are related to that. To the drug are topics that should be addressed by special people who are into this and investigating this or studying this topic. Our role here, our intention is to find a more integral use for the leaf, for the coca leaf, as powder or as flour or other uses that we have presented. But that I would say that that topic of consumption and traffic and other things has to be left to other, they have to be left to people who are more versed or who are studying the topic, have been studying the topic.
Perhaps, David, you could also explore, you know, how can communities ensure that if coca is legislated, that it's used for illicit purposes? Or is that the role of a government? Or can that be self-regulated within the communities?
Well, back to both of those points, I think I just wanted to emphasize that science has not found any negative effects of coca leaf so far. And when there has been research, it's very difficult to do research with coca leaf. We're trying to change that. But when there has been research, it has not found that coca leaf leads to any of those uses. It's like a coffee. Slightly stronger, potentially more effective, and doesn't create as many jitters. But anyway, in terms of the control of coca leaf, so that it's not diverted into, you know, the boogeyman, cocaine. I think Bolivia offers some interesting live examples of that, as well as Peru. I think in neither of these countries, if you look at consumption rates for the variety of drugs that there are, first, they're lower than here. Secondly, supply chains for coca leaf. I think Paul would be a great person to answer this as well. There's a regulatory framework for commercializing coca leaf that enables you to access coca tea, coca flour, and a variety of products, and it's not associated with diversion into cocaine. It's really complicated to make cocaine from these products that have been turned into packaged goods. It's much easier to go get it, get fresh coca leaves in, you know, the remote areas where it is grown. So it's not, I wouldn't say it's a very large problem. And the traceability mechanisms, for which there are many in cannabis, they're growing, and for the pharmaceutical industry, there are a good transportation practices that can be used, almost copy-pasted for coca leaves. So I don't believe that that's a very significant concern.
I would also add that that you're right, that addiction is very problematic, and that the consumers and the producers are the most vulnerable actors, and that they have to be protected, definitely. So, but I also know that thinking about a world free of drugs is unrealistic, and that the cost of the war on drugs are higher in terms of human rights, because the producers are carrying the heaviest load, right? So I think that at least in terms of human rights, if human rights are important, and that's our approach, right? The war on drug hasn't worked. It hasn't worked for 40 years, okay? And there's still cocaine coming out of Colombia, of Bolivia, and of Peru, even though the high cost in human rights. So the costs are very high, and it is necessary to make peace with those with the most vulnerable. And that means to protect the consumers and to protect the producers, who are the poorest ones in this story.
So I know Dora had something else very quickly to add, and then I think we'll move on to another question.
Solamente para aclarar que esta experiencia que hemos tenido y que hemos tratado de registrar en Lerma es una propuesta real de construir políticas desde las poblaciones más locales, rurales y lejanas, subiendo hacia la toma de decisiones del nivel central. La iniciativa surge por una comunidad rural que encontró la forma de negociar, digamos, de revalorizar una práctica que estaba considerada marginal y que poco a poco ha ido ascendiendo hasta lograr un permiso a nivel nacional. Consideramos que esa es una forma de hacer política, de modificar las políticas desde lo local.
I'd like to mention the study and the data we have gathered from Lerma, gracias. Lerma, Cauca, sorry. And that shows that this is a very the community is very it's a community that has worked on their own ways of bringing their proposal to the all the way up to the legislature. In other words, they have been able to develop or design a normative for how they carry how they represented a proposal, and this has been heard by the legislature. So this would be another way of doing policy in terms of how we can change change the approach, not from the top to the bottom, but from the bottom up.
Were there any other questions from the audience? Yes, the lady here in the glasses. Yeah, if you want everyone to hear your question.
Thanks, everybody. I was just curious if everyone could maybe comment a little bit more. I mean, you speak a lot about the criminalization of the cacao plant, but what about the criminalization of indigenous communities? I mean, I was just thinking of global resonances because I did a lot of work in prisons in Hawaii, and I'm thinking about how Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders and indigenous people are criminalized here in the U.S. and, you know, overrepresented in our penal system. So I know you mentioned a little bit about the self-reporting of indigeneity, but I'm wondering if that was really underreported in Colombia. And yeah, just if you could maybe speak a little bit about the criminalization of indigenous people.
Who was your question directed to?
I'm sorry, I don't know your name. When you had mentioned that, like, only 3% of people identify as being, you know, straight out indigenous. I'm wondering how underreported that is, and especially when you're talking about mestizo cultures and sort of mixed race cultures in Colombia.
Okay, so my point was actually to draw the contrast between the cocaine producers' countries. So I wanted to make the difference, to make clear the differences between, for instance, Bolivia or Colombia, where in Bolivia there is a higher proportion of indigenous population, of people who self-identify. I think it's 60 or 70%, okay? Whereas in Colombia, it's 3%. This might be, there might be an underestimation, for sure, but I did wanted to mark that there are differences, and I also wanted to show that even though the differences that indigenous groups in Colombia, for instance, are involved in drug production for as a commercial crop. All right, so we have indigenous group producing cannabis, for instance, indigenous group who have a long tradition of coca consumption producing cannabis for the drug market, or indigenous group who have a history of yahe consumption, and they produce coca for the drug market. So indigenous groups are also involved in the drug trade, okay? Just as Afro-Colombians, as mestizos, okay? And yes, there is your question about prosecution. The prosecution, according to the figures we have now available, it's like 255 people who are incarcerated for cultivating coca, which is not really significant. I don't really know what's the proportion. What's the proportion of indigenous people incarcerated for this matter. But this is generalized. Okay, so the production of coca is being done by people from very diverse backgrounds. Okay, including indigenous people.
Again, I'm very aware that we're short on time, so perhaps we'll have two more questions from the audience, take them straight away and then answer. Yeah, the gentleman in the blue shirt? Oh, no, sorry. Yeah.
Hi, thank you very much. I just was curious, there's a narrative in Peru that coca cultivation is from Andean farmers who are migrating to the Amazon to produce. And a lot of there's a lot of resistance from indigenous tribes. To coca cultivation because it often entails their lands being occupied illegally, and that's titled indigenous land. And I was just curious: are there indigenous peoples in Colombia that are actually actively resisting the cultivation of coca on their lands?
So I think we'll take another question, then we'll answer that one. Yes. Yes, please, that'd be great.
I was curious if in the Lerma Sena model, there were insights that were taken from the coca industries of Bolivia and Peru, whether the model is similar or how it diverges.
Okay. So perhaps you want to answer that last question. Were insights taken from the models in Peru and Bolivia to develop the model you had in Lerma?
I'm going to let Dora answer this one.
And perhaps you could translate sort of in shorter. Yeah.
Okay.
That'd be great.
La gran diferencia es que las producciones en Bolivia están protegidas por la legislación y la experiencia en Lerma está, digamos que de una manera marginal, es completamente marginal dentro de la legislación colombiana.
The difference between the question in Bolivia is that in Colombia it's considered a marginal, it's marginalized, the Lerma situation. But in Bolivia it's allowed, it falls under the what the law allows to do. But while in Lerma it's not considered, it's marginalized, not considered fully lawful.
Y la otra diferencia, pues, bueno, hay muchas diferencias, pero la más importante también es que entre la Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta y Lerma, las personas que cultivan coca en la Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta pertenecen a grupos indígenas y las que están protegidos por la legislación a partir de la Constitución Política del 91 o del 93. ¿Cuándo fue la Constitución? 91. La gente de Lerma está haciendo realmente una resistencia práctica, acudiendo a lo que nosotros mencionamos como la zona gris de la legislación que tiene el país. Entonces, por ahí fue por donde nos metimos para tener la oportunidad de hacer algún ejercicio de transformación.
There's a difference, actually there are many differences between the Lerma people situation and Sierra Nevada Santa Marta. Sierra Nevada Santa Marta is protected under the legislation that was a result of the constitution or the change in the constitution in 91. And the other, they're protected under that, those legislation. What has happened in Lerma is that we are basically taking advantage of that, what we call the gray zone. And so they have, in fact, doing some resistance in a way, because we haven't been able to kind of go in or find that wedge to enter and use this the gray zone, the situation with the gray zone, the characteristics of that this gray zone situation allowed us to go in and offer this resistance or start this project with them.
And I think the other question was, has there been any resistance from indigenous people who found that Colombians or perhaps internationals are moving into their lands to cultivate coca?
Actually, I have learned of similar experiences in Afro-Colombian communities who have organized themselves to try to prevent the drug trade from coming into their communities. And these communities that have a strong organization, that have local governance, that have a strong sense of identity, in some cases have made the opposite choice that Lerma has made, which is not to grow coca. And I think that those observations, which you find not just in indigenous communities, but in Afro communities, tell you about the importance of having the community drive its own future. And so when we think about the right to grow coca, I think linking that up to communities and to communities' decision about their own fate is really important. So in terms of indigenous communities, I don't actually have knowledge on that. Potentially Dora or Maria Clara do as well.
Well, from what I know, in the north of Cauca, for instance, it's not that they can't resist. They could totally, well, first of all, they have a tradition of coca consumption, but they do want to control control the amount of coca that is being planted on communal lands. It's not that they just want to be away from coca. They don't want to be close to coca. It's that coca is permitted as a cash crop to supply the drug market, but in certain quantities, in limited quantities. And like indigenous authorities, because they have strong organizations, grassroots organization and an indigenous hierarchy and structure, they are able to control the amount of coca plants that are on these communal lands, and that's to prevent the mafias, to prevent violence, to prevent, you know, to kind of save, to protect the community. But it's a fragile balance, if you want, because they're still cultivating food crops. But they need a cash crop. So they do coca, and they do cannabis, and they do coffee as well, okay, as cash crops. And it's actually very successful in what sense? In the sense that they can control this, but they are able to control this to maintain social control, and to make a living, okay? But that's possible in those indigenous community with strong organization, with strong grassroots organizations.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that's all the questions we have time for. Oh, one more, apparently. Yeah.
My name is Doug Willinger, blog Freedom of Medicine and Diet. I did the COCA 95 panel 20 years ago at the Drug Policy Foundation. Anyway, my question is about the use of coca versus tobacco. People using coca leaf to get off tobacco. If you look at the history, the USDA banned coca. They had the big scare campaign against coca because if it was being used as a tobacco habit cure. And they did it at the time the U.S. took control of the project to build the Panama Canal, which was complete in 1914, the same year as the Harrison Act. And I can attest that coca is great for getting off of coffee, and I've had friends that have used it to reduce their consumption of cigarettes. And when you consider that coca is the safest stimulant, tobacco is the most dangerous, and it's a confusion like confusing powder caffeine with coffee, it's a monstrous public health fraud they got away with, and it needs to be more stressed. My question is how much research is being done on the use of coca to combat the tobacco plague?
Paul, I don't know if you want to tackle that one.
Well, I don't know if tackle's the word, but I actually, one thing I do want to say is that one of the least studied aspects of drug history in the United States is the tremendous popular and medicinal use of coca that happened in the late 19th century. And what is true is that that began to fade away mostly not with the Harrison Act, not with drug prohibition, but with the FDA Acts in 1906, because coca was mainly interpreted by the government as a gross adulteration of drug products. And that was a historic mistake, I think, on many, many, many grounds. In the 19th century, one of the most interesting phenomena that occurred, apropos some of the other questions and issues that have been brought up here, is that there was a division between, in the medical profession, used to be much more diverse than it is today with just, you know, the reign of allopathic medicine, between those doctors, and especially British doctors and some French doctors and American doctors, who preferred coca
and coca as an herbal or a tincture, and those that valorized cocaine as a modern drug. And there actually were a lot of medical writings. There needs to be more work about this, analyzing the superiority of coca as a cure and coca as a medicine, and even coca as a nostrum, because it obviously made you feel better to have coca in whatever it was you were drinking. Now, to get to your specific question, I have never heard that theory before. it's possible that there were tobacco coca cures in the late 19th century, but I've never heard that as a major explanation as to the drive against coca in the United States.
1910 USDA publication, habit forming agents, look it up. Habit forming agents, 1910 USDA.
Esos son los vacíos que tenemos que resolver. Y esas son las necesidades que tenemos de investigación. Es muy importante que sepamos que la prohibición lo que ha logrado es alejarnos de la información de calidad. Y lo que necesitamos ahora es hacer ese tipo de investigaciones. En Bolivia hay una persona que se llama Jorge Hurtado, que ha trabajado el manejo de la coca para consumidores problemáticos de cocaína. Y dale.
Those are the gaps we need to fill. That's the investigation that needs to still be carried out. The prohibition has definitely created an aura of wrong information about that. There's actually in Bolivia a person called Daniel Hurtado, who has been doing studies about this. Usted puede elaborar más acerca del señor Hurtado.
Y en Colombia recientemente se lanzó un reporte sobre artículos indexados sobre coca, de investigaciones sobre coca, y solamente encontraron nuestros compañeros de Elementa entre 43 y 45 artículos, lo que significa que la información es, digamos, casi nula. Entonces, no tenemos información actualizada, no tenemos información confiable, y eso es lo que necesitamos con urgencia para poder tomar decisiones a nivel político y a nivel científico y a nivel de comunidades. Entonces, nos urge como comunidad y como sociedad tener documentos confiables, recientes y con tecnología actual que nos permita tomar decisiones y construir políticas.
We know that there's in the archives, there's indexed or studies that have been laying there, or we know of the existence of them, but my colleagues of the organization I work for, they're only being able to pull 45. That means that that it's a very poor. I would say that in terms of the up-to-date information, we don't have what we need to really start an investigation and have a more modern scientific approach to this topic. We haven't, out of all those indexed articles, we know that there have to be more than that. We have only been able to find 45.
Thank you, everyone, for coming, and for the panelists as well.
Thank you.
And I thoroughly encourage you to pick up a copy of the report, which you can get as you leave. It's available in English and Spanish.